Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3am.
Welcome back to Crib Notes. It's Rick and Dr. Sarah here.
Hi there. Today we're talking about introducing food. An exciting time.
Sarah, it really is. I can tell you the blender has never been so much in use in our house recently.
So with nutrition, we know the basics, but which sugar is good sugar? Is that even a thing? We thought we'd invite back Professor Mary Futchell. She's a leading expert in nutrition in the UK. We're going to talk about how to prevent hidden sugars within our kids' diets.
And also going to touch on the safety of vegan diets and how on earth you pull small children away from chocolate. Just a quick note from us, thank you so much for subscribing. And if you do know anyone who has young children, tell them to try us out.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Mary, can I just start off? What is the most common question that you get asked in your profession?
Given that I spend a lot of my time doing things to do with infant nutrition, it would either be, when should you introduce solid foods? Or, increasingly, are vegan diets safe for babies, which has become quite topical with the sort of increasing interest in plant-based diets.
Are they?
I think the bottom line is that, yes, it is perfectly feasible to safely feed a baby with a vegan diet and for a mum to be vegan, but it does require the mum to understand some of the issues and to take advice, basically, sensible advice about supplementation, because if you don't, the consequences for the baby can be sort of devastating, including irreversible brain damage, for example, from B12 deficiency. So yes, it can be done, but it requires some thought and a willingness to listen to advice. I suppose sometimes when I hear vegan diets being discussed in the news, we're told we should all be going towards a more plant-based diet. I think there's not so much discussion about how that applies to different age groups, and there are particular age groups and sections of the population where you need to take a bit more care. So pregnant women would be one, but also infants, because their nutrient requirements are
such rapid development.
They're growing rapidly, their brain's still developing. So if they become deficient in nutrients like vitamin B12, the consequences will be much more severe than if, say, a 30-year-old was slightly deficient in
that. So parents need to look at the nutritional composition of
basically. Well, I mean, I think really, and obviously, I think a lot of vegans are really well informed about their diet, but this is a really specific situation. So really, you should take advice and follow advice from your healthcare professionals or a dietitian, so that you make sure you're planning the baby's diet properly. So most vegan mums would hopefully breastfeed, and if they're well supplemented themselves, then their breast milk will provide the nutrition for the first 6 months or so. But after that, they need advice about what foods to introduce and what supplements the baby needs.
And when it comes to foods and weaning overall, what are the pros and cons of 4 months versus 6 months for weaning?
It's sort of slightly unfortunate that we've sort of ended up almost having these sort of two end points for when you should introduce complementary
feeding. Have I put my foot in it?
No, well, not particularly. I mean, no more than everyone else does, I think. It's sort of become one of the most heated discussions, I think, in infant feeding. And it's sort of slightly unfortunate, really. I think it's almost overshadowed the baby gets, which actually, in a way, is more important, like what you feed the baby, not exactly whether you do it at 20 months or 20 weeks or 24 weeks.
Different
or,
babies are different.
And different
it's
babies
arbitrary.
Are different. And so I think from a nutritional point of view, so the word complementary feeding means that the baby needs foods to complement the nutrients from the breast milk.
Mm.
That's where the name comes from originally. And most of the data would suggest that breast milk has enough nutrients for babies for about 6 months for a healthy term baby if the mum is well nourished. So from a nutritional point of view, the baby probably doesn't need a lot of food before that. But you shouldn't forget that there are other aspects to weaning, like,
And those other aspects can include, the lifestyle and job of the mum as well, because it's something that my wife's been talking about recently. She plans to go back to work at 6 months. And then, that has a knock-on effect to nutrition then, doesn't it? So, you've got to make these choices. These choices might be forced upon you.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think, if you think about the non-nutritional aspects of weaning, things like, you know, the baby taking an interest in foods and, you know, showing interest in wanting to eat things that other family members are having. And, you know, being exposed to tastes and flavours and things, that can be done with, you know, quite small amounts of food. So you're not necessarily providing a whole meal. But equally, if you and your baby are happy exclusively breastfeeding to 6 months, well, that's fine as well.
So in some ways, this argument, it's more in low-income countries where there is a higher risk of infection, where it would be more key that a mother was to continue until 6 months, whereas we've got lots of access to clean kitchen facilities and provision of food in the UK. Yeah.
Too clean, maybe.
Possibly too clean. I mean, I think that you're quite right. I mean, in sort of lower income countries where they don't have clean water and the sorts of foods they have available for the baby are not suitable, then the benefits of exclusively breastfeeding for 6 months, particularly protecting them from infection, are higher. There are still benefits to more prolonged exclusive breastfeeding in the UK against infection, but then you're not as likely to die of an infection in the UK as you are in some of the other lower income.
And I would say, as a mum, this is not a medical evidence-based opinion, this is just a mum opinion. Mums don't need to run in front of the train, you don't need to rush, because actually you've got all that to come, all the prep.
I mean, I suppose what we don't want is for mums to feel pressurised that somehow, you know, at 4 months they must be giving their babies other foods, which it should really depend on you and your baby and what works for you.
I've heard mums say that they were worried that their child would be behind with their development and they would lose those feeding cues if they didn't start early. And I think that's also something that we should myth bust that isn't the case. 6 months is perfectly adequate. They are likely to take all of the foods at the same rate.
I think the other important thing to remember is if you do exclusively breastfeed for 6 months, it's really important that when you do start complementary foods, you must provide something that has iron in for your baby. So, you know, whereas if you started maybe some purees a bit earlier, you have a bit of a more of a running,
gradual,
if you like. But from 6 months, if a baby's had exclusive breastfeeding, they will need to have iron quite. It's probably one of the most important nutrients to think about when you're actually doing the weaning. So making sure that you give some foods that have iron in.
And the things for mums to look at when the child is ready to feed are things like the interest in food, no longer tongue thrusting, being able to hold their head up, and good head control.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is all gets, you can get into quite heated discussions about this because, you know, how do you prove that a baby is actually interested in food rather than just interested in anything in general?
Throw it back at you.
Just because, you know, they're putting something in their mouth doesn't mean to say that they want to eat it, you know, or even know that they're supposed to eat it.
Mouthing is also a developmental
I think all of these things
goal,
are difficult. Clearly to take, this is the sort of development to take a pureed food is clearly very different to the sort of development you need if the baby's going to be, you know, self-feeding or, you know, as in baby-led weaning or something. So you have a whole range of sort of skills that in babies, they develop in a fairly reproducible order, but of course at different times. But the other complicating factor is that I think they're also affected by the experiences that the baby has. So if a baby is given experience with a spoon or experience with eating, it will probably sort of start to learn those skills as well. So it's really complicated and we really don't have very good data on these developmental milestones and how they are relevant. So again, I think you have to really consider it at an individual
level,
infant basis.
And nutrition wise, can we give children, babies, snacks at 6 months? Can we?
Well, I mean, at 6 months, I doubt they should be having much anyway. Treats. Now, actually,
sugary treats?
Treats comes back to the whole idea of this responsive feeding that you should be, recognising when your baby is hungry, when it's full, and you shouldn't really be using food to reward. So the use of food, when a baby has been or a child has been well-behaved, I know it's something we all probably do. I've probably been guilty of it myself. It's easy to do, but you shouldn't really be associating food with reward. You should think of other ways of rewarding.
They're not a dog.
They're not a dog. And also, you shouldn't use food as a punishment or withhold food as a punishment. You shouldn't try and modify behaviour using food because then the child will start associating it wrongly, really. But going back to your question about snacks, I mean, it depends what you mean by snacks, of course. The idea of having you know, some small food item, if it's, for example, a piece of fruit or something between meals, is one thing. But if you're talking about giving, you know, chocolate bars or bags of crisps or...
I was talking about treats.
Treats.
You mean
why can't fruit be a treat?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question to throw back at me.
I think in some ways we should not really be even using the word treat. Food should be food. And as soon as you start bringing emotion into food and saying that this food is bad and this food is good, it's not going to create a healthy relationship with food. And that can be a problem in the future. And it's about everything in moderation, I guess.
I think so. But I mean, I think the sort of idea of snacks as something you have like between main meals is not inherently bad if it's something sort of healthy. The problem is, I think what we tend to do is our snacks don't tend to be the healthiest of foods. They're often like convenience things and often high in sugar.
Yeah.
And sugar, I think, has become a big problem for infants and children in particularly higher income countries. Actually, it's occurring now pretty much everywhere, that there's so much sort of sugary food available. And some of it's that the labelling can be quite misleading, because you can have food that's labelled no added sugar, which, you know, legally it doesn't have added sugar, but it still has these free sugars, which sugar is sugar. It doesn't really matter whether it's free or added.
And fruit itself is very high in sugar. So if you are having, for example, preserved mango, that can sometimes have a higher concentration than even confectionery.
Yeah. This is why it can be really confusing. And I think the other important thing is that if you have sugar in a whole piece of whole fruit, that has much more effect to make you feel full than if you have the same amount of sugar in a squashed form, like in a smoothie or in a fruit juice, because it gets absorbed very quickly. You drink it very quickly. And it doesn't produce satiety. So that's why generally it's not advised that parents should use too much fruit juice. I mean, a small amount is okay, but using fruit juice as the main drink apart from milk is not a good idea, because it does involve quite a lot of sugar.
I think it's important for parents to understand what we mean by free sugars. Can you explain that in more detail?
Well, I mean, essentially, I'm talking about just sugar that has a metabolic effect in your body. And it doesn't matter whether it comes from a piece of fruit or it's something that's added, or you put a spoonful of sugar from a bag into it. It's sugar, and it has the same effect in stimulating your insulin. And it provides calories and things.
I think one thing that's interesting for parents is that actually having sugar as a solid, as eating the sugar, is very different than drinking a sugar. Your body has time to prepare, whereas actually you can get hundreds more calories if you were to drink it. The way that your body processes it is very different.
Yeah. I mean, there's the classic experiment where you give people like 6 oranges to eat. They have to peel them and eat the oranges versus the juice from 6 oranges, which you can easily just drink down without even noticing. But if you actually have to peel and eat the oranges, you won't get beyond about 3 before you're full, because you have the fibre and things as well as the sugar. So generally, it's better to give fruits, you know, as whole fruits. Obviously, you have to be very careful with young babies, because you can't be giving them lumps of fruit that they might choke on. But it's better to have whole fruits than to have fruit juices.
And in terms of when we're weaning children, what types of food do you think are best to wean babies onto?
Well, of course, there's a big cultural element to this. So, you know, you could give an answer for one cultural group which wouldn't necessarily translate to another. So, you have to go along with what the family's sort of dietary habits are. But I mean, typically in this country, if you're talking about giving the sort of more pureed things, it tends to be the sort of baby cereals or perhaps pureed fruits and vegetables.
Green vegetable, yeah.
It is really important to give some of the you just mentioned, the green vegetables, the dark green vegetables, the sort of more bitter tasting things, because we're all born with this sort of innate liking for sweet things, which probably was good when we had to seek out energy in the past. But now we're surrounded by too much sugar and too many calories. We don't really need to be reinforcing this.
Yeah.
So it's all too tempting, because the baby will look pleased when it's given something sweet, to just sort of pursue that. Whereas often when a baby's first given something bitter, it won't necessarily look particularly pleased, and it might take 10 or 15 tries before it will actually start to accept it. But you need to really persevere
to
try and get those sorts of tastes in.
Because they don't know any different at that time anyway. It's worthwhile putting the effort in for them to enjoy a variety of different foods.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that's the key, giving whatever you start with, you need to give the baby a variety of foods and including not just sweet things. And another point there is that if you look at the commercial foods, they do tend to be more predominantly towards the sweet end. Not surprisingly, because if manufacturers were to put, say, broccoli in a jar, the baby would probably not be very pleased and the mother wouldn't buy it again. So commercially, they're not a sort of a great seller.
And it's I think the other issue is the preserving aspect, isn't it? So some of the, for example, vegetables, all of the packets are labelled as carrot. But actually, it's pear is the predominant feature in there. And so it's like looking at the back of the packet, because for them to actually keep it in a packet, the preservative that they're using to say that it's organic, for example, has to be a sweet element like a fruit.
Yes, that's completely true. And in fact, there is going to be some work by the Public Health England on the sort of sugar content of some of the commercial foods. But of course, it's parents aren't just using commercial foods, so it's equally as important if you're making home prepared foods not just to focus on the sweet things as well. Because, you know, I often get asked, actually, I get asked a lot, actually, one of the other questions is the home prepared versus commercial weaning foods,
because there's been such a rise in them.
Well, the short answer is
depends what you're making
at home. You could be giving something absolutely terrible at home with, you know, added sugar and salt, in which case the commercial foods might be better. So it completely depends on you know what you're giving. And
sometimes I feel like there's two extremes. There's parents almost burn out because they're trying so hard to do all these healthy foods, and then they go bounce back to unhealthy pouches. But actually, it's about trying to make family meals and actually just saving some of your evening meal, making sure it's not got too much salt in it, and just using that the next day.
I think particularly as the baby's getting
older,
towards a year. I mean, the ideally, if your own diet is fairly good, you should be trying to sort of involve the baby with your diet as much as is possible. But again, it depends on what you're eating, really. So
be aware of no added sugar.
Yes, I think when you're looking at labels, it's worth not just assuming because something says no added sugar, that means it doesn't have sugar in.
Many things are labelled as healthy, but actually they have high amounts of sugar in it, and it's just about making people aware of that, I guess.
I think so. I mean, it is a complicated thing, food labelling, because, you know, you could have something. Yeah, so fruit juice, for example, can have quite a lot of sugar, but equally it also contains some beneficial things
some
as
nutrients.
Well. The same with the sort of milk type drinks. I mean, ideally, infants should have either, you know, breast milk or an infant formula, and then when they're a bit older, maybe cow's milk. What they don't need are milks with extra sugar and extra sort of flavourings in, really, because all of those things should really be treats.
Treats. That word's come up again.
Sorry, I shouldn't have used that word. You said we wouldn't use it. You know what I mean. They should be
not a regular part of
diet. Not a regular thing.
Something that you have on occasion, or special occasions, maybe.
Right. So I think the guidelines that children shouldn't have more than 5% of their diet as free sugars, but actually children are getting nearly double or three times at the moment. So we do need to be looking at
that's with the slightly older children. I mean, really the infants under two don't really need any sugar.
No.
They can get all the sugar they need from the milk and from other. Yeah, they obviously have carbohydrates in their diet, but they don't need sugar as such. We don't have a nutritional need to have sugar. It's something, I guess, our ancestors wouldn't really have had access to much sugar. They would have maybe had fruit or honey or something occasionally, but they weren't surrounded by it in the
way. I guess it's a rise of convenience foods.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And people are now talking about what we call the obesogenic environment, aren't they? Mm. That we're so surrounded by these foods that it's become basically normal.
Yeah, and we're surrounded by it and we're predisposed to like it. So it's the sort of perfect storm, really.
Yeah. And it's tricky, isn't it? Because I think parents think that they're being kind, giving their child a treat. I know we shouldn't be using those words.
We need another
word. But actually,
we
should think about it differently, because, you know, we wouldn't give a child a cigarette, would you? And I know it's not giving you the same immediate harm, but long term, if you're giving multiple treats a day, actually it does have many of the similar problems if you are in excess.
Obviously, the other aspect of all the sugar is teeth. which, you know, is the actually the more acute effect.
And we have so a many really fillings. Bad problem. So many fillings.
I think actually a lot of the slightly older people had a lot of fillings because we ate a lot of sweets, probably.
I had 24 before I was 18. 24 fillings.
What did you eat?
Well, you know, I apparently my teeth were just susceptible to decay.
But it's the commonest cause of general anaesthetic in children
it
now.
Is. Really? I mean, this is, we have a really significant problem with tooth decay in preschool children. Mm. I mean, the number of children that are having general anaesthetics to have their baby teeth removed because of decay. I mean, it's really, really worrying. And it's really a preventable thing. So if you are doing tooth brushing as soon as the first tooth erupts and limiting the amount of sugar, then this doesn't need to happen.
And I think one thing that parents don't realise is it's about acid attacks. So if you're sipping a drink throughout the day, your teeth are all day exposed to that acid. Whereas if you drank that drink in one go, that's one acid attack. It takes 20 minutes for the pH of your mouth
that's
to go back to
point.
Normal.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point.
And also, I mean, if you just, you know, have the, say, a fruit juice drink with a meal or something, then clean the child's teeth afterwards, then, you know, that should solve
if
it.
It's doable,
rather than
if it's doable.
If it's doable.
We'll cover that in one of the other podcasts.
Yeah. Can I just say I've had only one filling since I was 18. So obviously, you know.
But there's no space for
a leopard can change its spots.
One thing I wanted to talk about is organic vegetables. Do parents really need to be spending money on organic vegetables?
Okay, well, I wouldn't say I was an expert on organic food, but my personal opinion is probably no, certainly not with infant foods, because they're pretty highly regulated anyway in terms of you know, pesticide residues and things.
So expensive as well. There's no way you could afford it.
I mean, I think I'll probably get lots of people complaining about this, but to be honest, I mean, the commercial complementary foods are very highly regulated by EU regulations, and so I cannot really see how an organic food is going to really be any better, particularly for that sort of age group.
And frozen foods as well. One thing I'm trying to highlight essentially is that parents might say that healthy food is more
fresh.
Expensive, but actually there are many foods that you can get which are relatively cheap and healthy, and frozen options can be just as nutritious.
And I mean, I think that, you know, there is some evidence that if fruits and vegetables are frozen quickly, they can actually maintain higher levels of vitamins and, you know, good nutrients.
Some evidence on that and peas,
and some fresh things. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think frozen foods are fine as long as they've been, you know, from the hygiene point of view, they've been frozen appropriately.
Stored appropriately. We have lots of children who are eating very high sugar breakfasts. Do you have any solutions for this?
That's where I went wrong. Ricicles. I think that was the cause of all the fillings.
Well, I mean, I think this is maybe not so much with the really young babies, because they tend to be given the sort of more baby cereals, which are perhaps less of the high sugar. But once you start getting through the sort of toddler age groups where they like these sort of more sugary cereals, I think it can be a problem. I mean, I guess the solution is, I mean, cereals themselves, I think, are very good. And these products often have quite, you know, good quantities of vitamins and things, which so they are useful in the diet if they didn't have so much sugar. So I guess you want to get children accustomed to the brands that don't have the very high sugar. I mean, I know also the manufacturers are trying to address this. This is some of the work that's going on with Public Health England, working with manufacturers to try and reduce the amounts of sugar in foods.
So there's a fair bit of work being done on that, hasn't there?
There is a lot of work. I mean, I think it's not completely straightforward, because actually, if you just take sugar out of foods, a bit like you found with salt, when they try to reduce salt, then people just won't buy them because their taste has to almost adapt. And also the problem is that if you just remove sugar from the food, that's nothing to stop the consumer just adding more sugar from the packet.
But I guess it's as well. So, for example, the sugar tax, one of the reasons for the sugar tax was to put pressure on the companies to reformulate.
Really,
and they successfully did that, because some people would argue that it was nanny state.
Yeah.
But
it's
pragmatic.
I mean, I think the sugar levy has been very successful in actually getting reformulation of the food, so there's much less sugar in these sugar sweetened beverages, so by implication people are being exposed to less of it. I think the problem is, in, you know, there's lots of discussion at the moment about whether to extend the sugar tax to include like fruit juices, milk drinks and things, which yes, in theory, would be good to try and limit sugar in all its forms. It just gets a bit more complicated when, as I said earlier, you've got things that have some healthy things in benefit as well. Whereas sugar sweetened beverages, no one can argue that they have any nutritional benefit.
And so, I guess it is a bit of a blunt tool, and it does, some people argue, target the low income families more than the high income families. Yeah. And so people would argue it's a bit...
It was sort of regressive in the sense that it's actually, potentially having more impact. But then the argument would be that
they are the higher risk,
unfortunately, for child obesity. If you look at the results from the school measurements at 4 and 11.
To summarise, we need parents to look at what they're feeding children and actually think about the content of the food. So breakfast muffins are essentially cake. Things like dried fruit bars may actually be
worse. So look for the sort of sugar that may not necessarily be apparent, but not just in commercial foods, in home prepared foods as well. So think about not having too much sugar. Also giving enough iron when you first start the weaning process. So either things like, fortified infant foods often have iron in, or you can use things like if you're giving your baby meat, some red meat, that's a very good source of iron that's very bioavailable. But iron is a really important nutrient, and the babies have very high requirements in the second 6 months of life. So don't just go on feeding your baby like pureed vegetables or fruit.
Mary, I've taken a lot of stuff from you today, but iron is the one thing I'm going to go away thinking, give that child some iron.
Brilliant.
Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3 a.m.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.